Ladies and gentlemen, please stand by. We're about to begin. Good day, everyone, and welcome to the WebSphere Support Technical Exchange Conference Call. Today's call is being recorded. Now, for opening remarks and introductions, I'd like to turn the call over to Ms. Christy Snyder. Please go ahead, ma'am.
Okay, thank you, Richard, and welcome to today's WebSphere Support Technical Exchange. My name is Christy Snyder, and I will be the moderator for this call. This call is being recorded, and within 24 to 48 hours, an MP3 file and presentation will be available on the WebSphere Support Technical Exchange site. You may replay it at your convenience. If you have not yet joined the e-meeting, please do so now. An e-meeting URL is available to you from the WebSphere Support Technical Exchange site. Today's presenter is Michael Patton. Michael is a Level 2 Defect Customer Support Representative. He is also a regular presenter at the User Share conferences. Today's topic is WebSphere Message Broker Top 10 Problems, a Level 2 Perspective. It will include a PowerPoint presentation. During the presentation, all lines will be muted. After the presentation, I will ask attendees to answer a few quick questions via e-meeting polling. After that, the lines will open for a question and answer period. If you are in the e-meeting, you will see the presentation. If you are unable to access the e-meeting at this time, you may access the presentation from the WebSphere Support Technical Exchange site or by going to any IBM.com site and typing 7007462 in the search box in the black section at the very top of the page. At this time, I would like to turn the presentation over to Michael. Please go ahead, sir.
Good morning, everybody. This is Michael Patton. I am with IBM WMQI Level 2 Support. I see some of you on this list. I've probably spoken with many of you on the phone at previous times. I welcome you to this presentation. This presentation is just a kind of a basic overview of some of the top 10 problems that we've seen with Level 2 Support. Slide 2, please. Today, what we're going to do is the first thing, the number one thing that we seem to see on Level 2 are failing deploys. Then we're going to go into the toolkit, some problems with the toolkit, some data flow memory leak problems, debuggers or RAC or broker in RED, which is RAP, which is the remote rational application developer, as well as message flow hangs, some publish and subscribe problems that we've seen, and some MRM invalidations that we've also seen. And also, I'm going to discuss a little bit about our support on the website that we have. And at the very end, I'm just going to go over some of the latest APARs that we've addressed with us. Slide 3, please. We'll start with failing deploys. Failing deploys is probably one of the biggest things that we've seen come across in Level 2 support. There are, I know the slide says three possible scenarios, but there are actually really two. No response at all or a negative response. Error on deploy kind of falls as a subcategory for both of them. The common deploy error messages that we would see and that you would see in your message broker log, either in the event log or the message log file on your Unix systems, are your BIP 2080s, 2066s, 2087s, and 1536s. Those are all pretty generic messages. They just give you an indication that something happened with your deploy. Usually it's the last one, the 1536, that'll tell you exactly what happened. Slide 4, please.
And while the screen is painting, I'd like to remind everyone that if you are unable to access the e-meeting at this time, you may access the presentation by going to any IBM.com site and typing 7007462 in the search box in the black section at the very top of the page. Thank you.
Okay, failing deploys. One of the first reasons we'll see, as I mentioned in the previous slide, is that a failing deploy is that you get no response at all. I know you've probably worked on a message flow or your message set. You've put it into your bar file and you send it off and wait. Nothing happens. Not really sure what happened. What we have to do in order to determine what exactly happened if you do not get any type of message deploy is first look to see the message logs or the event logs. We just try to gather some clues as to exactly what happened by looking in these logs. We can also look for MQSEC errors. Usually what we find if there's no response at all is that there is a problem with the communication. The broker may not have even known that it had had a message deployed to it. However, one thing we would note is that when you do a deploy, if a configuration manager knows that a deploy has happened, it will wait a certain amount of time for a response, and then it will give you a response timeout if nothing happens from the deploy action. Slide 5, please. With the no responses, usually it is some type of infrastructure problem. Messages couldn't get through, the channels weren't there, the message was too big to be sent across. Some of the things we try to look for is, are the MQ objects configured? Are they configured properly to send the overly large message? Are they configured to even send it to where it's going? Maximum message lengths are usually one of the first things we look at, make sure that the channel is big enough to handle the deploy message. Usually the messages, the bar files can get quite large, especially if you've got a huge dictionary that you're trying to deploy. Now, a dictionary is just another word for the MRM or the message set that, or the message model that you have developed. All MQ series will return their codes, and we will capture them in our event log through the use of the BIP 2070. Another problem that you might see with the infrastructure is that there's a database problem. 9 times out of 10, the database problem is that the password or for the ID that is accessing the database is changed. What you have to do in those cases is when the database ID is changed, you have to stop the component and issue an MQSI change broker, MQSI change configuration manager command, making sure that you give it the latest password, because we hold that information in cache, encrypted, of course, but in cache to submit to the database. There are some additional notes at the end in the addendum concerning some of the slides that I have here, just giving more details about what some various messages actually mean. Slide 6, please. The second reason why we would have a failing deploy is a negative response. By far, the biggest reason we've seen for getting a negative response is that the configuration manager is unable to register for internal subscriptions. We see that quite a bit. This does not mean that your deploy failed. All that is telling us, however, is that the deploy did work. However, the configuration manager cannot communicate through our internal PubSub infrastructure to let us know that it actually did get there. The configuration manager just simply can't receive the updates from the broker, and the toolkit will not tell you exactly what the status is. You will often see in the toolkit where it says the broker's not running, but when you look at the broker processes and messages are being processed, well, broker is running. The toolkit just isn't telling you that. What you have to do is make sure that the service ID that is defined on the broker box is the same service ID that is defined for the configuration manager. Now, that service ID doesn't need to be the actual ID that runs the broker. The ID just needs to be defined on the broker box. And what this does is it allows the broker to communicate back across to the channel using the proper IDs so that our internal PubSub commands can be processed and sent across the channels back to the configuration manager and back to the toolkit. Page 7, please. Continuing on with failing deploy and negative responses, configuration timeout or configuration delay timeout. If you get a negative response back, another thing to think about is how big of the deploy message was it that you sent. We've already gone over earlier where if your message broker was not set up to process such a large message, or the MQ objects like the channel, transmit queue, and the queue manager itself, have been set up to, say, 100 megabytes, and you know that the components can handle the size of the message, but is the broker allowed enough time to process the message? If you have a very large message, and you're deploying it to an already active broker, the first thing that the broker has to do is shut down the flows that are being traded out. And in order to shut the flow down, it first checks to see if there's a message in the flow. If there is a message, then it will either wait for that message to finish, or it will try to back out that message. The timing that it would take for it to do this is all determined by exactly how big the message is, how complex it is. Is it waiting on other components? So we just have to kind of wait to see how much time a flow takes to quiesce, because we cannot trade the flow out while it is still running. So we actually have to shut it down before we can trade it out. What we can do is change the amount of time that we're giving the broker to do this. This is issued with the MQSI change broker command. There are two attributes to that command value for this, the dash G and the dash K. I kind of like to think of it as the dash G is how much time am I going to allow for the deploy. Okay, I'm going to give the deploy 60 seconds. I want to say you have 60 seconds to finish this deploy. The dash K is saying how much time am I going to wait before I start counting that 60-second timer down. That's kind of like saying, it's okay, you have 30 seconds. If I set that to 30 seconds, I'm going to say, well, the broker, you have 30 seconds to do everything, to follow. You always get at least 30 seconds. And then from there, you have another 60 seconds. So for a total of 90 seconds is what you have on a broker deploy when you configure the dash G and the dash K parameters. Line 8, please. One way you could also affect the sizes of the deploys is also to minimize the scope of the deploy. If you have a bar file that has a whole bunch of message flows and a whole bunch of message definitions put in it, you may want to reduce the bar file. Reduce it to the point so that you only have a couple of message flows and the message set that those flows are using. Break it up into smaller pieces and deploy in smaller chunks. That way it's not waiting for everything to shut down. It's only waiting for one or two flows to shut down. The message, the deployment message is smaller, and it will take less time for the broker to process it. There's more commands that you would actually have to do, more deploys that you would have to do, but it keeps the keeps everything smaller and working better for you. Slide 9, please. Now, when you're working with a failing deploy, one of the things you may want to look into is, are we actually getting anything on over to the broker? Is the broker processing a message? Do we actually see it? And is there a way that I can look at that broker, look at the message logs and say to myself, did that deploy message I sent out, did that actually ever get to the broker? We have an environment variable that will help you with something just like that. It's called MQSI show deploy. The MQSI show deploy environment variable works both on Windows and Unix, and it inserts a message into the message log that pretty much just tells you, okay, we're processing the deploy message. What it does is it helps to isolate a problem. If you're deploying a message flow, we can use that variable from time to time to see how far along the message got. If we deploy our message and Windows from the Windows machine and the AX machine where, say, the broker lives, never gets this message in the message log, then we could pretty much be assured that, okay, we're looking at the configuration manager or an MQ problem. If we see a first message showing us that the message actually came into the broker, but we're not seeing anything where the message broker is sending something back, then we know we're going to isolate right into the broker. And if we see that the message flow came in, broker processed it, and we see another deploy message sending the message back to the configuration manager, but we're still getting a failure response, then we'll probably have something on the tail end of sending the message back. All this really does is it just helps us isolate the problem. We can certainly check message logs for any other MQ database or other operating system errors that may provide a clue for failing deploys. Like I said earlier, failing deploys is probably the number one call why level 2 is called. We try to get a deploy to send out, and it just didn't work. There are a lot of things that need to be configured between the configuration manager and the broker in order for a deploy to work. There's just a lot of pieces that come into play. We have the toolkit, we have the configuration manager, we have MQ series, we have databases both for the broker and if you're running version 5, we have a database for the configuration manager as well. Well, that about wraps it up for failing deploys. I know we have questions and answers at the end of the presentation, so I'll just hold off to the end for any questions on deploys. Slide 10, please. One of the other big reasons we get calls here at Level 2 is people are complaining about the toolkit. It is slow. You have this huge mapping file. You've been working on it for a while, and you try to save, and sometimes it can take, I've had some try to save, and it takes 45 minutes to save. You go in, you have a huge ESQL file. You change one line in it, and it takes another 45 minutes to save. 45 minutes is a long time. I wouldn't say we see a whole lot of 45 minutes But a lot of times it does seem like it's just taking a very long time for it to save. Make any changes into it, trying to close it, trying to open it, trying to import. Things just seem to take a long time. And you see, if you were looking into the event log, I'm sorry, the task manager on Windows, you could see that the Java W process is just working away. You're not getting any responses that it's saying it's not running, that it's being unresponsive. It's working. It's just taking a long time to do its thing. What we want to do is most likely is you want to, What happens is the message broker is looking at everything that's in these files, the mapping files, the ESQL for the compute nodes, and it's mapping them up to your MRM. And it's matching them up to the message model that you've got going on with it. It just wants to make sure that everything you have coded in here is as it should be. It's kind of like doing a check for you. It's validating your ESQL to make sure that you're mapping valid fields, that you're not trying to map something that isn't supposed to be there. The simplest and easiest, most effective way to speed things up is to turn off the validation at all, turn off the validation at saves. This is accomplished by just clicking on the Windows menu, drop down to Preferences. That'll open up a new dialog box where you'll see in the dialog box for your tabs ESQL and mapping. And under the ESQL and mapping, if you expand that, you'll see validation. You'll see validation is currently set to warning. What you want to do is set that to ignore. And that will turn off the validation on the toolkit so that the toolkit is no longer going to validate each and every time you try to save. The save operation also includes when you're closing the toolkit down. It's just going to assume, hey, everything I'm going to ignore, so I'm not even going to go through that validation code. That will certainly speed things up for you. This does not mean that you can no longer validate it. You can still validate your message flows and your just by right-clicking on the project itself and dropping it down to validate message. That will run out and check it. But when you do that, if you've experienced where it's taken up to 45 minutes for you to validate it, you'll still have to wait your 45 minutes, but now you have much better control over when you're going to do those validations or not. The other thing that we see with the toolkit is it just blows up in your face. The toolkit can shut down mainly because there's been a JVM exception. The toolkit is based on Eclipse, which is based on Java, and a lot of times we see a Java exception for it. Many different flavors of Eclipse, many different versions, lots of Java files out there that are going into building the toolkit. You've probably seen that when you try to install it, and it seems to take forever to install, and then you look at the directory, and it's consumed a huge amount of file space, disk space on your hard drive. Those, we have to kind of take those on an as-is basis, each one, to see exactly, okay, what happened to the toolkit? And in order to find out what happened there, we have to look into the log file for that. The log file for the toolkit is found wherever you have your workspace. You will find a directory in there called .metadata, and in a file in that folder called .log. And the .log message will usually let us know exactly where the problem is. We can look at Java, and it'll tell us what component it's having a problem with. You can certainly take a look at that. If you ever call level 2 and you're having problems with that, we would certainly most likely ask for that log file to just help us evaluate what is going on with it. Slide 11, please. Excuse me. Some debugging issues where it comes to the toolkit. You can attach the debugger to it. I'm going to get into a little bit of the remote agent controller a little bit later. But the toolkit is slow, or it terminates whenever you're trying to use the debugger as well. Usually during debugging, that's when you're going to find out that you were having a problem with the JVM. What we want to discuss on this just briefly is that the large projects can take up a lot of resources. Huge files, especially if you're using with XML, because XML expands threefold to what you would think it would be. Because XML, you not only have the message itself, you also have the starting and ending tags for each thing. That's going to take up a lot of memory. Large messages in the toolkit are intensive or resource intensive, what we can do is try to increase the amount of Java heap size that the toolkit can have. That is accomplished by altering the MQSI Studio command. Most folks have a shortcut on their Windows machine to their Studio, to their toolkit. You can either edit that shortcut directly, or you can call the toolkit from the command line, giving the parameters that you want to give. I've put in here on the slide here an example of the MQSI Studio and the commands that you would want to put in with it. That would be the -vm args /XM. Then you're going to have some type of value followed by a capital M, and that value is going to be the number of megabytes that you currently want to have for it. We have to keep in mind that the default size for real memory on the system, or for the JVM, is 1/2 the real memory that is on the system. So if you have 2 megabytes, or if you have 2 gigabytes of real memory, you're going to get a stack size of 1 gigabyte. You can increase that up to, Java has a limitation of 2 gigabytes. So that's a Java limitation, not a toolkit limitation. Slide 12, please. Data flow engine and memory leaks. We've taken some calls where people are complaining. I'm watching my data flow engine process. It just takes more and more and more memory, and it just keeps consuming and doesn't seem to ever give any of it back. Well, the data flow engine can't give its memory back. However, the data flow engine is expected to eventually reach a plateau. The consumption is based upon the resources that are needed for each message flow. If you have a real simple message flow, if we just start off with the easiest message flow that we have, which is an input node and an output node, we're not going to expect a whole lot of memory. If you start piling huge messages through that, we're still not going to require a whole lot of memory because we're not going to be processing a message in an input and an output node. However, if you have a very complex flow, multiple paths, many flow orders, if you have some ESQL that is parsing the entire tree, we can see, especially if you're using an XML method, where the memory consumption for that particular flow is going to get quite large, because each and every node kind of has to maintain a memory of where it is in case we're rolling back. So the complexity of the flow and the size and type of the message will eventually cause data flow engine to consume memory. The data flow engine does obtain its memory from the operating system and then hands it out to the threads. The threads are the actual flows themselves. The data flow engine is a process. The flow is a thread. The data flow engine, there is no programmatic way to return memory to the operating system. So the only way that the memory from the data flow engine is returned to the operating system is when the data flow ends. However, threads can return memory to the data flow engine when the flow ends. We tend to keep that into a pool. Going back to the flow sum, if we're looking at a flow, and it's quite complex, we know that it can consume quite a bit of memory. Now, let's say we take that same flow and we have multiple instances of that flow deployed. So we have a lot of messages coming along. We're going to be trying to process some of these very large messages in parallel. Each one of those threads is going to require the same amount of memory, so it's going to keep asking the data flow engine for more memory. Now, the data flow engine is just going to keep getting more memory from the operating system until it has enough to fulfill the request of the threads, until the operating system says, no, you can't have any more. But what I have to stress here is that with data flow engines, they are expected to reach a plateau. We do expect our data flow engines to get to a point where the memory that they have should be sufficient to handle the messages that are flowing through it. Oftentimes, that may be more than what the machine has to give it, more than what is available for it, which is why we sometimes think that we have a memory leak. Slide 12. Slide 13, please. simply put, if we do think that a memory leak is simply just that the data flow engine has not reached its plateau yet, one of the things we want to do is try to give the data flow engine more memory. On AIX, we can change how much memory it has by giving it more segments, memory segments on AIX. We can give it as many as we want, but at a certain point, we have to kind of quit thinking, okay, this broker is probably demanding too many resources. Break it up. Certainly, 4 segments will give it 1 gigabyte of memory. 8 segments will give it 2 gigabytes of memory. You start getting beyond 8 segments of AIX memory, then you're going to start running into the MQ segments, and you go beyond that, you're going to start running into kernel segments, and then we'll have some real problems. We really do try to just say limit yourself to the 1 gigabyte. We also have the MQSI thread stack size environment variable. You can set that value, and that value is set in bytes, and that will increase the thread stack that is available for all the different threads, just how much memory each thread has to work. That's useful, especially if you have very complex flows, or even if you have some ESQL that may be called recursively. We can also increase the JVM heap size for the broker. Same properties apply as they did before with the toolkit. You can go up to 2 gigabytes, and that is accomplished with the MQSI change properties command. I have the exact syntax listed here in the slide. That pretty much wraps it up for data flow engines and memory leaks. The number one thing just to keep in mind for data flow memory leaks is that usually there's too much resources being asked for than what is available to the system, rather than there is an actual leak. And the way that we would test to find out if there is a leak is, do we ever see that the data flow engine actually plateaus or not, or does it just continually grow and continually grow until it has to shut down, and then it just keeps growing? And we could test that by, the only way we would test that is just try to isolate the flow that we think is causing it, removing all the other resources and seeing and testing the resources one by one to see which resource is actually not plateauing. That's how we would diagnose data flow memory leak, and usually that process does take some time. Slide 14, please. Okay, so we've got our flow. It's out on the broker, and it's out on our development and our test broker. We're trying to see what's going on with it. And we find that the debugger is not working. Well, the two main problems that we see with the debugger is that the list of execution groups do not show up when you try to connect your toolkit to the broker, or you do get your execution groups, but you don't see a list of message flows. Usually, this is just a configuration issue with the remote agent controller. The agent controller uses as a default port of 10002 for its communications. First thing we do to look for is just to check that the port status of that particular port is netset. That port, if you're trying to use a debugger, that port must be active and have a status of listening on it. Oftentimes we find that there is a firewall between the toolkit machine and the broker machine. The default port for RAC for the remote agent controller can be changed if you want to configure it to allow things through your firewall, or you can set up your firewall to allow communications on those port, on port 10002. In order to do that, you just simply edit the serviceconfig.xml file. You would also need to edit the toolkit window to point to the same port that you save the port in the serviceconfig.xml. Slide 15, please. The other reason that we would see for the debugger not working, well, for continuing on with the debugger not working, is that the agent controller, we have found that the agent controller must be started before the broker is started. That allows the broker to register components of itself with the remote agent controller. If you're finding that you're having problems connecting, we recommend that you shut down the broker and then restart it, and during restart allow the broker to try to communicate with the agent controller and get things set up. We also have seen in the configuration file, back to the serviceconfig.xml file, there's an element in there called allow with an attribute host equal to local. If you set that to allow host equal to all, that will allow any host to communicate with it. It is set up defaultly to host equals local, just for security reasons. Don't want to open things up just to everybody anywhere to get in. And thus we ask that the customers, if you want to let other machines to get in, you certainly go ahead and change that. You can also put in there, if you just want specific machines, a comma delimited list of the hosts that you want to have all to be allowed to access this machine. Remote agent controller will write its log messages into the service log.log file. This log file is in the same directory as the serviceconfig.xml file. Currently, the logging is set pretty low. We don't give a whole lot of details in there. If we're going to be trying to debug a remote agent controller problem, you've probably seen or will see from us, we'll ask you to change the logging level and the logging details to high. These are all attributes in that same XML file, and they're right up there in line through in the third line down. They're pretty easy to spot. We also want to also make sure that you currently have the correct remote agent controller installed for the correct CSD. On version 5, if you get past CSD 4, we ask that you have a remote agent controller version 5.0.2 installed. It's just how things are configured. If you're still running with 5.0.1, we're going to ask you, and you've got a higher CSD, we're going to ask you to move up to a higher CSD. That's about all I have to say on the remote agent controller. We'll move to slide 17, please. Rational application development. This is just a real short one, just a one slide thing. What we found is that if you're using the Rational Application Developer or Eclipse, and you're trying to get some of the broker perspectives installed, some of the broker plugins installed, the toolkit, if you're trying to install the version 6.0 of the toolkit, you need to have Rational Application Developer version 6.0.0.1. If you're trying to use toolkit 6.0.0.1, you need to have Rational Application Developer 6.0.1.1. Doesn't make sense based on the numbers. You would think that the toolkit 6.0.0.1 would work with Rational Application 6.0.0.1, but this is a problem we've run into on several occasions, so I'm just bringing it up on one slide. You will get compatibility errors if you try to install a toolkit 6.0 on Rational Application 6.0.1.1. Slide 17, please. Message flow hanging. We really need to just kind of make sure when we're looking at a message flow hang, is it truly a hang or is it a case where the messages are just simply not being picked up from the input queue because there are messages stuck somewhere? A message flow hang, the message could indeed be actually stuck in the flow, or the message flow has actually taken a message and for whatever reason, exceptions were thrown. It didn't know how to handle it, so it fell back on the default error handling and spit it back out to the input queue of the flow. Whenever you spit that message back out to the input queue on the flow, then it's going to kind of depend on MQ series as to, okay, do I have a dead letter queue set up so that this message, which can no longer be read by the flow and has been tried as many times as my backout depth has been set, now it's just going to sit there blocking other messages. What we recommend at this point is, I mean, the easiest thing to do is just to define a backout queue for our MQ series. So if the message flow, and you want to allow the message flow to handle things using default mechanisms built in, then any error messages will go to a dead letter queue to be handled by the MQ or the MQSI administrator at their convenience. And that will still allow other messages to get through. Excuse me. Or you can handle error messages within your flow by wiring up the catch with a failure terminal on the input node and send those messages off to a desired queue. Or if you can have in your own flow error handling exceptions, that will actually take care of the error itself. There are pros and cons for doing it each way, for which way you want to do it. Whenever you, if you let the default actions put the message back out onto the input node, you'll find that transactionality will actually be rolled back. If you have a message and you handle it yourself and you send it off to a queue yourself using either the catch or the failure terminal of the input node, the message will still be considered successful and all changes that were made along the way will still be considered complete. That's just for transactionality purposes. You have to kind of define or decide how you would want to handle it, default action or not. Another thing that we've seen with message flow hangs has to do with aggregation. On the aggregation node, are the unknown timeout, catch, or fail terminals wired? Has your MQMD header been built? Message will continue to loop within a flow and hold up other messages as if it cannot be put to a queue coming out of the aggregate reply. Just something to keep in mind when you're using message flows and you think that they are hanging. Usually if we do see that we're hanging, and you call level 2 for this, we're going to first go through and check to see if you've got any error handling actions set up for it, and then we're going to want to try to capture a trace. Best way to stop a message flow that is currently in a flow that you think is hung is we have to shut down the flow itself, and that will force a rollback of the message. That's how level 2, how we're going to handle those requests. Slide 18, please. Publish and subscribe. I think I have a customer on here that we've dealt with on the collectives issue that I'm talking about right now. The collective issue with publish and subscribe that we've seen has to do with how communications and inter-broker communications are handled. Communication for collectives is handled by TCP/IP except for the initial handshake, and that is via MQ because we have to find out the other queue managers and send information off to the other queue managers, and then we use TCP/IP to communicate between those other brokers from that point on, which is why we've seen my communication seems to be working, but I'm not seeing any messages flowing across the channel. That's why. If you add a new broker into your collective, or you have a previously removed a broker and then tried to re-add it, you must restart all the brokers and issue a complete topology deploy. What that will do is force the handshake across all the channels so that all the brokers can get all their neighboring information from each other. So you need a complete topology deploy so that all brokers are aware of the changes. Another thing that we've dealt with on Publish and Subscribe has to do with the subscription registration option VAR user ID. VAR user ID is just simply designed to allow another user to either delete or alter a current subscription that is registered with the broker. This does not indicate multiple owners for a broker. Subscriptions are defined by the queue manager name, colon, the queue name, colon, the correlation ID. What we found, and there is an APAR for this, but what we have found is that if you tried to register a subscription, or had tried to register a subscription with the VAR user ID, but actually tried to register the same subscription, queue manager, queue name, but with different IDs, the actual registration would go through. You could register it. However, we found that then the broker publication or broker subscriptions and the broker client user tables ended up being corrupted. In order to fix that, in order to prevent having multiple users trying to register on the same subscription, the APAR was put in to prevent you from trying to register with multiple user IDs. But what you want to do, if you want to have different users register to the same queue manager and queue, you have to also ensure that you use the correlation ID as part of the registration option. And to do that, you just simply use correlation ID as a client ID when you're as one of the registration options when you're when you are registering your subscription. Slide 19, please. Another thing that another AFAR that we've addressed recently on Publish and Subscribe is if you set up clone brokers, you have one, you have two brokers, one of which is a clone of the other, and you try to register a subscriber on broker A. Broker A is going to send a copy of that registration message off to broker B so that the clone will be updated. We have found, and an APAR has been addressed for this, we have found that there is a slight chance that if the, that the subscription message to broker B could actually be lost if the broker is down, if broker B is down, and MQ series gets shut down. Simply meaning that the subscription message that broker A sent off to broker B was not put on the system.broker.control queue as a persistent message. We've changed that with the APAR, and you'll see that fix in future CSDs. And just leading flash in the topic will also fail. That's going to kind of wrap it up with publish and subscribe. If we can move on to slide 20. With the MRM and validation, we've worked on some CMRs where we have an attribute, where we have an XML attribute nil equals true. The XML attribute nil equals true is supposed to act as a placeholder, especially when you have repeats or arrays. If you have a message and it has five child elements, all with the tag name of element, so let's just call it element. But the third one of those happens to be null. You want its value to be null. You still need to maintain that you have five child elements, all with the name element, or let's change it to field so we don't get confused, all with the name of field. But the third one has no value, but you still need it to be there as the third element. You can certainly use the XML attribute nil equals true as a placeholder in there. That's fine. We understand what that means. However, the schema, if you're using this with a message set, and you think by setting the schema to say that it can take a null value, that this will work. Well, it does not, because nil equals true is an attribute, and most folks do not actually define that attribute in the element itself as an attribute of the particular element, saying, okay, I could have this attribute here, nil. The message model will see nil equals true as an attribute and will fail to validate it against the message set. The solution for this is to use the null XML schema in the physical format. That way you do not have to define nil equals true. We've also found recently when we tried to import a C header with a reserved C, C++ keyword, a keyword in the structure name will fail when you're trying to create a message definition from a C header file. Simply put, you cannot use reserved keywords as a structure or a variable name. We've had a PMR on this, and I thought I'd just address it here because pretty much the response we got back from our developers on this was that you can't use reserved words. Slide 21, please. XML parser performance is slow, especially when you're using parsing tags, or slow when parsing tags with large numbers of entity references. In XML, an entity reference is pretty much some type of reference in there that would use the name ampersand LT semicolon. That's if you wanted to try to actually have in your message a less than symbol. A less than symbol in XML is considered the beginning of a tag. So if you actually want to have the less than symbol as part of data, you would actually have to use the entity. Essentially, in order to get around this is try just to reduce the number of entities that you have if you can. And if you find you have any particular message that has a lot of these entities in it, we recommend that you try and closing it into a seed data so that the parser doesn't even try to parse them, but more than just taking that data and just leaving it alone, which is accomplished by using the seed data. The last thing that we've said I'd like to talk about on MRM is XML namespaces with identical namespaces but different prefixes. You're trying to build a message, and you have various namespaces in it. And in this namespace, you would have XML namespace colon NS1, and that is pointing to www.ibm.com. You have another prefix in that same message that is referring to www.ibm.com. We've had complaints that, well, shouldn't we preserve those prefixes? Shouldn't the message broker be able to say, okay, we have these prefixes, and we want to make sure that these different prefixes, yes, even though they are pointing to the same URI, we want these prefixes to be preserved. The broker will not do that. The broker does not work with the prefixes. The broker actually will expand what that prefix is when we're dealing with it. If you were to look at a trace of that flow and in a trace node, you expand it out, you will not see in the trace for all the various elements the NS1 or NS2. What you will see is www.ibm.com or whatever your URI was when you're putting the message through for that name, particular namespaces. Those two URIs are functionally equivalent. And when we try to write that message back out, we will write it out with the first particular prefix that we have to use. We won't try to differentiate between which prefix this one is, which prefix this chunk is, and yes, it's pointing to the same URI, but it has a different prefix. We will no longer try to parse that back out. That is how XML is put together, because the prefixes are primarily for human readability. They're not for machine readability. Unfortunately, the broker just cannot handle them. So if you want to make sure that you maintain two different namespace prefixes, I guess the best way to do that would be to alter one of the URIs ever so slightly just before putting it through the broker, and then you can certainly change the URI once the message comes out of the broker. Slide 22, please. In dealing with support in Level 2 and IBM, IBM is currently having a new support initiative which is geared towards self-help. We have programs in place, websites in place that will allow users to get to IBM. We've opened up a lot of our databases to be searchable from the Internet so that people can get in and look through them. The site for this, I've listed the URL here. This URL is updated daily from multiple sources. We have information and tech notes and things that Level 2 representatives write, Level 3 representatives write, some things that the developers write. We put all these together along with other information. We have knowledge engineers at IBM that are putting information into this database. All these things can certainly help, you know, if you're getting some type of common problem. We have this website, which will certainly help. A lot of times, Level 2, we search on that same site. You give us a call, that's one of the places that we look, primarily because it's going to the same database, and it's one single source of information to get into them. Slide 23, please. Here's a screenshot. The only screenshot in the presentation, so we'll wait just 1 second for it to come up. I know screenshots take a long time on these e-meetings. This is the latest flavor of what the screenshot looks like. You'll see kind of in the middle of the window there, that's under where it says search support in this product. This is for the WebSphere Message Broker product. That is our single line interface to search all of our database repositories. We also have on this page recommended updates. So you can check back here to see if we've got CSD7 out, or you can subscribe to flashes and other information. But if you're not subscribed, you can just certainly check this particular website to see if we have any latest updates currently available. We have a whole list of support packs that you can download. Support packs are sometimes product extensions, or sometimes, or different categories of them, are simply things that someone somewhere has written that they think will be helpful. There are various categories of the support packs, some of which are supported by IBM and some of which are supported by the owners of the support pack, and some of which are just put out there. Use it if you want. There is no support implied with it. They are neat. Some of them are helpful. Some of them are redundant. I recommend that if you're looking for some particular functionality, that would be a good place to look, especially if you're looking for a user-defined node or looking to develop a user-defined node. You may find on the support packs that the node has already been developed. We find quite a few of them there. All right. Slide 24, please. I see I'm running out of time, so I'm just going to kind of briefly go over these. These are just some of the noteworthy aid pars and other useful websites for level 2. You can take a look at these if you like. Some of these are aid pars that you will be able to get. You could certainly call level 2, and we could supply you with a copy of the aid par if you need a particular aid par, or if it's already been released. These are, I would anticipate, be released in the next CSDs. But if you're having any problems with these, you can certainly give level 2 a call. Slide 25, please. Some useful websites I've put in here, the support site again. We also have some Redbook sites. This page was essentially just put together as just a list of links that you could use to find lots more information. We have some news groups. We find MQSeries.net is a particularly good forum. You will find in there that you have some level 2 representatives in there, level 3 representatives and developers in there who have answered questions. That's just kind of a forum. People get in there. If you might recognize some of the names, you might not. But that's not only do some IBM representatives post information in there, we also find that we have other people who are using our product posting information in there as well. Slide 26, please. This chart includes links to a number of sites that provide valuable online resources for WebSphere products. Developer Works offers in-depth technical information. The events link on support pages will point you to webcasts and other conference information. You can visit WebSphere.org for user group information and more product information. The IBM Education Assistant consists of a self-help module to get new users up and on the learning curve quickly. The ESR tool is for Passport Advantage clients to open, update, and view PMRs online. And the My Support link on all product support pages lets you sign up for weekly email updates for products that are of interest to you. Slide 27. Do I have any questions?
So thank you, Michael, for a great presentation. We would like to conduct a short poll now. Questions will appear in the e-meeting. Your participation is greatly appreciated. The first question is, on a scale of 1 to 5, choose the number that best describes how you feel about this statement. The information presented today was useful to me. Please enter 1 if you strongly agree, 2 if you agree, 3 for neutral, 4 if you disagree, and 5 if you strongly disagree. The second question is, on a scale of 1 to 5, choose the number that best describes how you feel about this statement. The material was well organized and clearly presented. Please enter 1 if you strongly agree, 2 if you agree, 3 for neutral, 4 if you disagree, and 5 if you strongly disagree. Question 3. Did this call meet your training expectations? Please answer 1 for yes and 2 for no. Next, please provide us with comments to help improve future webcasts. And I'll just pause for a moment in case you want to answer. And finally, is there a topic you would like to see scheduled? And I'll just pause for another moment. We welcome any ideas that you may have. Thanks again for your participation. At this point, we would like to open the line for questions, please, Richard, and I will now turn it over to our presenter.
And if you would like to ask a question today, please press star 1 on your touchtone telephone at this time, and if you're on a speakerphone, make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Once again, it is star 1 to ask a question today, and we will pause for just a moment to allow everyone a chance to signal. Our first question comes from Rick Tiedemann.
Hi, it's actually a really quick one. Can you tell me where I could download the actual presentation? There was actually some really good ideas, and I'd like to have them kind of to be able to look at them later again.
Sure, I can actually answer this question for you. If you go to any IBM.com site and type 7007462,
okay.
7007462 in the search box of the black text section at the very top of the page. There's a link there. You can also go to the WebSphere Support Technical Exchange site, and you'll find the replay information posted with the audio a couple days after the after today.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Once again, ladies and gentlemen, it is star 1 to ask a question today. At this time, we have no questions. I would like to provide everyone one further chance to signal for a question. Once again, it is star 1 to ask a question today. It does appear we have no questions at this time.
All right.
I'd like to turn it back to Ms. Snyder for closing remarks.
Thank you, Richard. So at this time, we will conclude the presentation. We hope the information presented today has been valuable to you. We appreciate your participation as well. Remember, a replay of this presentation will be available on the IBM WebSphere Technical Exchange site within the next day or two. We hope you will join us for future presentations, which will also be announced on this site. Thanks very much for joining us today, and thank you, Michael, for presenting.
You're quite welcome. Hope you all enjoyed it.
And ladies and gentlemen, at this time, this does conclude our teleconference. We once again thank you for your participation, and you may disconnect at this time.